We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. This is Focus, hour two of our morning talk show. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Harriet Williamson is the producer for the show. Jason Croft is at the controls for this hour. Chances are you probably have seen someone do stand-up comedy. Maybe you've gone to a comedy club and sat in one of those little rooms at a little table where someone stands up on a stage under a light and tells jokes. Or maybe you've seen that on television. And if you have, you might well have asked yourself the question, why would anyone subject himself or herself to that experience? Certainly to the possibility of being humiliated and people throwing things or maybe just throwing insults. Well, perhaps it was that question that led this morning's guest, writer John Warner, to write his new novel. The title is The Funny Man, and it is his first novel. And it is, in part, the story of a man who was a once successful comic whose career is now on the skids. Worse than that, he is on trial for shooting someone who had tried to mug him. Much more than that, though, the author says that it's a book that's really about no matter how much we have and whether we're talking here about attention and love or material goods, it's never enough. John Warner is editor at large, or rather he's managing editor of McSweeney's Internet Tendency, where he has worked since 2003. He's the editor of three volumes of material culled from that website. He's a prolific writer himself. He's collaborated with, edited, and or published a number of writers, writers from New Yorker, Vanity Fair, Morning News, Salon, The Daily Show, The Office. Currently, he teaches at the College of Charleston, that's in South Carolina, and has also taught at Clemson, Virginia Tech, and University of Illinois. And he'll be, in fact, on the campus of the University of Illinois next week to take part in the CAR reading series. This is something that's sponsored by the Department of English and the Program in Creative Writing. And he will be making an appearance, giving a reading at the Author's Corner in the Illini Union Bookstore Monday afternoon. This is the 17th of October, 4:30 in the afternoon. And he'll be talking about and reading from his new book, The Funny Man, which is published by Soho Press. And he's talking with us this morning. He's with us by telephone. And as we talk, questions are certainly welcome. If you'd like to join in, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. And the email is will-talk@illinois.edu. And John Warner, hello.
Good morning. Hello.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
Oh, it's a real pleasure.
Mm-hmm. We appreciate it. And I guess it is my understanding that at least in part, this book did grow out of your having that experience, you know, going to a comedy club, seeing people do that and thinking to yourself, why in the world would anybody do this?
Yeah, absolutely. I was out on a trip to California and I went into the Comedy Store in Los Angeles, which is sort of the birthplace of every stand-up comedian you would know, like Seinfeld and Jay Leno and Steve Martin and David Letterman and all these guys. And on a typical night, 12, 15, 18 different comics get up for 5-7 minute stretches, and the vast majority of them do not do well, are not laughed at, are heckled, are given a hard time. And, they don't make any money, they don't get any pay, they don't get any glory, and yet there seemed to be an endless supply. And that notion just became very, very interesting to me, that question of what would drive somebody to get up on stage and keep trying to do this.
Yeah. Do you think that having thought about that and having developed this character and written the story about how this man goes from middling success to huge success, which then ends up ruining his life. Did you come up with some sort of answer why it is that somebody would do that?
Yeah, the original subtitle for the book, this was sort of in my moments thinking about my own novel in overly pretentious ways. I was calling it An American Saga. And my theory was that sort of if this is an affliction that hits stand-up comedians, it's really only a specific manifestation of the American condition, which is we always want something. And once we get something, even if it's the thing we thought we most wanted, we can figure out something else we want more. And I think the process of getting up on stage and trying to make somebody laugh is self-perpetuating that way, that once they've managed to get up there and get somebody to laugh, they want to do it again and again and again, not unlike a drug. Yeah. And, you know, like any sort of addiction, you need a greater fix each time. So I think it's sort of that way. You know, and there's the validation. You feel loved and validated and all those things. So I just think it becomes a sort of seductive dream that you keep chasing but can never quite catch, which I think is true about a lot of things in life.
Well, and I think, forgive this as sort of a pedestrian observation, but I do think also that the book is kind of an illustration of the old saw about be careful what it is you wish for because you might get it.
Exactly, yeah. No, it's and it's true with anything. And I identified quite a bit with it as a writer. You know, you always want more success as a writer. You want your book to be a bestseller and to have all this kind of success. But those milestones come with their own sets of problems. If you have a best-selling first book, now everybody's looking at your second book with a jaundiced eye. So it really is the kind of thing that I think is to some degree universal. And you know, you always read about people who've won the lottery. It's their dream to win the lottery, and then 3 months later they're divorced, broke, miserable, wish they could go back to their regular old job. So I think it's just sort of human nature at work.
Yeah. The title character here in the book is of the funny man is the funny man. He doesn't get a name. He's always the funny man. Why is he not Bob or Fred or George or, you know, whatever?
Right. There was a draft where he did have a name, although I only used it once or twice, and ultimately my editor convinced me that using it once or twice is worse than not using it at all, or is sort of a cheat. If I'm not going to use it, I should just go ahead and not use it. And really, the choice for him to not have a name came in the writing process. The first parts I was writing were in sort of the third person, where he just keeps being referred to as the funny man, the funny man, the funny man. And I expected a name to come to me at any given moment, except that it just never did. And later on, I began to feel like it fit, that his identity to himself and to others is as this guy, as the funny man, as this comedian. And to attach a name to him, to even give him a specific label like that, just began to feel just wrong for his particular story.
Well, the trouble, I'm sure, for people who do this is that they have to have something that distinguishes them from anybody else. They have to have a gimmick, or in the language of the book, they have to have a thing. They have to come up with a thing that's their thing that separates them from the other comics. And when he starts out, he's apparently an okay comic. He's not great, but he's also not terrible. But one night he's performing, and an agent sees him, and the agent seems to think he has some potential. But he says, "Well, you know, kid, you need a thing," and he comes up with a thing, which is what? What is the thing?
His thing that he discovers while playing with his infant child and laughing at how his son is trying to shove his hands and feet inside his own mouth. He's inspired by this and decides that he's going to start doing impressions while his own hand is shoved entirely in his mouth. So each impression sounds basically the same because his hand is shoved all the way in his mouth. And yet, in the novel, it's inexplicable, although I think if we sort of examine our own tastes of the American public and the things that we elevate to fame, it makes some sense that this guy who does these goofy impressions can become famous. So it really was intended to be a truly, truly nonsensical gimmick. Mm-hmm. And hopefully that comes across.
It pushes it right to the edge, to the absurd. And yet when you think about other comics and their things, well, this is, yes, this pushes it, but I'm not sure that it pushes it real far, because people have had kind of odd things as their things, and you think, well, what really about, what was it so appealing about, you know, a guy who put on a record and then stood there and lip-synced along to the record, and that was his thing, and apparently a lot of people found that very entertaining, so maybe it's not quite so odd that somebody would shove their fist in their mouth with the expected result, and that people would just be convulsed by that, but that's what happens in the story.
Right, exactly. Yeah, I mean, Gallagher has had a 25 or 30-year career of smashing through.
Yeah. So people's things are sometimes odd. So he comes up with this thing and becomes wildly successful. And then as I suppose often happens in show business, he becomes a captive of his thing.
Yeah, exactly. And again, this is sort of something I think we can all appreciate is he didn't know he wanted these things until he had them. So as he is able to fly first class or own a home or buy a new car or this kind of stuff, all of a sudden it's like he can't do without these things. And in order to service his increasing level of demands for his own life, he has to keep doing it. But really, if you think about any job where you do the same thing over and over and over again, it's going to begin to wear on you, and he doesn't handle it particularly well. Once or twice he tries to get out of it, but promoters or club owners make it clear that people came to see him do this, and he better do it.
There's a great moment here where he's doing a performance, and he's doing very well, and people are enjoying it, and then he finishes up and says, "Hey, good night, everybody. Thanks for coming," and walks off without doing the thing, and the promoter about tackles him off stage and says, "Where do you think you're going?" And he says, "Well, I'm done." And the promoter says, "No, you're not done. You haven't done the thing." And then he kind of says to him, and you know, offers to take him out back and have his kneecaps broken.
Right.
The funny man reconsiders, goes back out, and does the thing. And of course, the audience goes nuts, because that's really what they were there for. So it's an illustration that, well, maybe you do this thing and it becomes very popular, and then you decide, gee, I'd like to move on, but people they don't want to let you move on.
Yeah, the public has no interest in what you're interested in if you're a performer, and I often think of like my favorite bands or long-standing bands who have to go on the road over year after year and play the same songs, like. I don't know, for example, a band like Journey. I can't imagine they derive all that much pleasure out of playing Don't Stop Believin' again, except there's no way they could have a concert where they didn't play Don't Stop Believin'. There'd be riots. There'd be pandemonium if they got off. So I think it can be a trap. And at the same time, I think performers, one of the things I think he struggles with is that performers do owe their publics a certain amount of what they want, given that they are the ones who make his life as a performer possible. So, the desire was that this is sort of an irony. We can't feel all that much sympathy for him, given how much wealth and material gain he's gotten from his gimmick. On the other hand, tried to make it so we could appreciate that. Even being rich and famous isn't necessarily easy.
Yeah. Our guest in this hour of Focus is John Warner. He's a writer of humor, satire. He's managing editor of McSweeney's Internet Tendency, where he has worked since 2003. He has published his first novel, which is titled The Funny Man, and it's out from Soho Press, so you can look for it in the bookstore. He teaches at the College of Charleston. That's in Charleston, South Carolina. And next week, we'll be here on the campus of the University of Illinois to give a reading in the Car series. So if you'd like to meet him and hear him. He'll be at the Illini Union Bookstore on Monday. That's the 17th, 4:30 in the afternoon. Otherwise, you can go out looking for the book. And questions, comments here. Of course, people want to be involved in the conversation. They can do that, too. 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Did you must have, and because you also write in the humor vein, you must have spent some time thinking about what makes people laugh. I mean, what really humor is all about, whatever way it is you're trying to do it. Have you thought about what it is that makes people laugh?
Oh, yeah. Probably to an obsessive and ridiculous degree. And of course, I have no real answers other than some sort of provisional theories. One of the things that I think laughter does is it can unearth a feeling or an attitude or an idea that the audience has in their brains, but they didn't know it until somebody pointed it out and they laughed. It's sort of like a moment of recognition where somebody has crafted a joke in such a way where they say, oh, I believe that too, but I guess I didn't know that until you pointed it out. And that's sort of a very traditional kind of a joke that might rely on irony or pointing out a hypocrisy or something like that. I think if anybody watches The Daily Show, essentially the way Jon Stewart's monologue is crafted is to show the world to the audience in the way they already see the world but didn't quite know that they saw it that way. I don't know if that makes sense, but it really sort of unearthing these things they already believe. So it's not too different than any other kind of writing in a way, in that you're trying to speak to an audience, you're trying to tell them things or show them things that they instinctively resonate to and think are worthwhile. So in a lot of ways, I don't necessarily separate writing humorous things from writing other things, other than you're trying to make sure there's a laugh at the end and not just a sigh or a happy silent moment. You need them to actually laugh out loud.
Yeah, there's a early on in the book, there's I think a nice exchange between the funny man and his shrink. And the funny man is there, and he's talking with the shrink about the fact that he thinks he's a sex addict. That is, the funny man thinks he's a sex addict, and he's talking about the fact that he wants to get with every woman he sees. And then he launches into this riff about how many women there are, and then he says, it's like buying toothpaste. And then he goes into this riff about how you go to the store and there are all these different kinds of toothpaste, and ends up talking about how he making the comparison between the people in the restaurant that help you pick wine, and he says, yeah, one of these days we're going to need somebody there to help us pick out our toothpaste. And the therapist says, oh, is this in your act? And the funny man says, no, should it be? And the therapist says, it's very funny. The funny man says, you're not laughing. And then the therapist says, I don't laugh because I understand what's behind the joking, which isn't a laughing matter, but that doesn't mean it isn't funny. Now, I like that a lot, and also for a variety of reasons. I guess in part because it does illustrate the commonplace, which I think is also true, that humor, a lot of humor comes from a dark place, and that people who make their living trying to make people laugh have these dark places inside them, and that somehow that's connect, that stuff is all tangled up together.
Yeah, that's right. I think the process of finding humor or creating humor, particularly the kind of humor a stand-up comedian has to trade in, is really about finding things that are wrong with the world or wrong with themselves or off, just not right, and then showing them these things. And, I think if your brain falls into the pattern of, I'm going to keep finding things that are wrong, it can be an interesting and potentially dark place to go. And really, sort of stand-up comedians have this, the cliche of them is how messed up they are emotionally and socially, and they're all misanthropes and this kind of thing. And there's a bit of a chicken and egg question there. Is it that that being this way drives you to become a stand-up comedian, or being a stand-up comedian causes you to become this way. But as you sort of note from that passage, I don't think it's accidental. If you look at the world, if you look at the toothpaste aisle, and what you see is not an abundance of choice where you can find the exact toothpaste that meets your exact toothbrushing needs, but instead you see an overwhelming amount of choices that makes it impossible to find the right one, you're going to have a different outlook on the world, and that's the outlook that seems to either gravitate towards humor and comedy, or create somebody who wants to do that kind of thing.
Mm. Do you? I wonder though if it also it is that at least some people who deal in comedy actually have the impulse to say something very serious, and that they've somehow found that with a joke you can sneak something very serious by someone that they might resist if you were putting it to them in a more serious way.
Oh, sure, yeah. There's a lot of comedians, especially these days. I think we're in a sort of renaissance of the socially aware and socially relevant comedian. Mm-hmm. I can't say that I'm a scholar of these things, but I do watch a lot of stand-up and keep track of it. But for a while we had comedians like Seinfeld, who were primarily fairly gentle, observational comics who, you know, they would point at human foible and this kind of stuff, but there wasn't a whole lot of commentary there. And now, one of my absolute favorite comedians, as well as performers, is the comedian Louis C.K.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you're familiar with his work, but he has a show on FX. And in his show, it's sort of the story of him as a middle-aged divorced dad with two daughters. But he plays a stand-up comedian, and often it intersperses the narrative with actual scenes from his stand-up comedy. I was just watching a rerun last night, and he has a whole routine about how, living in New York, he's learned how to ignore the desperate homeless street people. And then he has a cousin comes and visit from out of town and wants to, you know, sort of appalled at this and wants to help them. He's really sort of, he's making a joke out of his own indifference, his own sort of trained indifference to human suffering. And it's really, really funny. He makes you laugh. But at the same time, he's forcing you to confront the reality of being in these places where I, too, might choose to ignore that person who's in desperate human straits. And it's a very complicated process. It's why it probably took 10 or 15 years for a comedian like Louis C.K. to become relatively well-known, why his show is on FX and not in D.C. like Jerry Seinfeld's. There really are a lot of comedians out there these days that do speak with conscience and are trying to deliver some sort of very serious message along with making people laugh and using that humor in order to get that message to land.
I was one of the things I was kind of struck by in the back of the book that you have some acknowledgments, and among the people that you acknowledge are such luminaries as Howard Stern and Artie Lang. I kind of think of those two guys together, and then also people like Steve Martin, but also writers, Dave Eggers. I think it's particularly noteworthy here that Philip Graham, who is a writer who's on the faculty here at the U of I and is kind of a friend of ours, is right next to Howard Stern, and I can't imagine any other time that Howard Stern and Philip would be like mentioned in the same sentence. What particularly from someone like Howard Stern or Artie Lang that are really in your face, do kind of in your face comedy that some people find distasteful? Would you learn something, you think, about humor from those guys?
Oh yeah, I might as well just sort of come out with it. I am a Howard Stern fan and listener. In fact, I turned it off 5 minutes before listening to it. 5 minutes before this interview started. That's sort of a tongue-in-cheek reference to that. While I was working on the book, I was listening to a lot of Howard Stern, and some of it invariably gets in there. The other part is a lot of the funny man's less savory moments as he's on his decline are inspired by, sadly, almost tragically, by some of the unfortunate things that have happened to Artie Lang with addiction and depression and this kind of thing. So, you know, there's a lot of inspirations in the book, but that was one of them. But it really is, you know, one of the things that's true about humor and comedy is there is no universal joke. There is no humor that everybody is going to find funny. Somebody's always on the inside. Somebody's always on the outside. And one of the things, sort of listening to Howard Stern, I think demonstrates to me, is how far is the envelope on one side. There's times where he will joke about things that I find morally reprehensible and appalling, and yet nonetheless I'm laughing. And that response, personal response, is just interesting to me. I think mostly because of writing, because I like writing about contradictions and how we may see ourselves one way but behave another. So I couldn't help but sort of add that inspiration. And I can't say he was as directly helpful as somebody like Philip Graham, but I wanted a little nod in the back.
Mm-hmm. Our guest in this part of Focus is John Warner. We are talking about his new novel, his first, The Funny Man, which is published by Soho Press. It's just out. John is the managing editor of McSweeney's Internet Tendency, and he will be on the campus to make an appearance, spend some time talking with aspiring writers, and also read from his work next week. We'll talk some more with John Warner in just a moment. First, though, we'll have a quick break. This is Focus.
Under Don't Ask, Don't Tell, Air Force Lieutenant Josh Seyfried started a secret Facebook group for gay and lesbian soldiers called OutServe. Now Lieutenant Seyfried is out, and so is his boyfriend, Air Force pilot Lieutenant Carl Johnson, who has been blogging for Time magazine as Officer X. Seyfried and Johnson join us on the next Fresh Air.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
Support comes from the Illinois Symphony Orchestra in Tragedy and Triumph with Awadashin Pratt in Grieg's Triumphant Piano Concerto and Berlioz's Tragic Romeo et Juliet, led by music director candidate Donato Cabrera, October 14th at Bloomington Center for the Performing Arts and October 15th at Sangamon Auditorium in Springfield. Details at ilsymphony.org.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're here weekday mornings, 10 until noon, and we have 10 different guests and different topics throughout the week. Tomorrow morning in the 10 o'clock hour, the guest is Dava Sobel. She's a science writer, and we will talk about her new book, A More Perfect Heaven, How Copernicus Revolutionized the Cosmos. And then in the second hour, we'll talk with Michael Goodchild. He's professor of geography at University of California, Santa Barbara. And we'll talk about how it is we represent geographic information, that is, all of the various ways we try to represent the world, the physical world, in a way that we can understand and navigate through. He is here on the campus to give a talk. This is in the MillerCom series. You can find out about other programs we'll do in the future. Listen to past programs. Go to our website, will.illinois.edu. In this hour of the show, we're talking with John Warner. He is the author of the newly published novel, The Funny Man, and it's published by Soho Press. He's also managing editor of McSweeney's Internet Tendency. John, if someone has not been to the McSweeney's website, how would you describe it?
Well, it's the online arm of Dave Eggers' publishing company, also a University of Illinois alum, as well as me. And the website's the publishing arm does a literary quarterly and books and magazines. They've just started a new food publication. But the online part of it is primarily a humor website where each day we publish a new piece of short, what we call casual humor. But we also have ongoing columnists who write about all kinds of things. We just had our column contest for the last year, and people are voting on who's the best one right now. And those can be any subject. We have one of our new columnists writes about being an 18-year-old freshman at University of Mississippi. Another one, she's 17 years old and is living in Egypt and writes about her crazy family. So it's a bit of a mix, but mostly meant to entertain and be the kind of site that's a nice diversion when you're sitting in the office and you need a little break from whatever you're doing, you click over to us and get a piece of entertainment that you otherwise might not have seen.
And I think it does really well for that. I have it bookmarked, and I've many times done that, and the pieces are generally short. So it just can give you a little lift and take your mind off whatever you're doing just for a minute or two. Although
yeah.
It's also possible to get sucked in it and ending up being there for a while. But it's a good site, so I would certainly suggest to people take a look at it.
Yeah, I use it the same way because most of the humor pieces I don't have anything to do with anymore. We have an editor who does all the selecting and editing of those. So I use it the same way. Now I'll click on it in the morning as I have my cereal and get a start to my day. You can get lost going from article to article, but the one thing we still have not fallen prey to is there are no links inside of the articles themselves. So you don't necessarily fall prey to something that happens to me, which is I start reading one thing and then click on the next and the next and the next and don't remember what I started with.
Yeah.
We still retain some purity of text.
You do teach or speak or both about humor writing. Is that something you think that can be taught?
Oh, yeah. Like any writing can be taught. Probably more easily than things like creative writing, like writing fiction or poetry, can be taught, because there are some very definite forms that you can utilize in writing humor. To write a joke, it's written in a certain template. So it can definitely be taught. I've taught it in the past. It's very fun to teach. I think the most fun part about it is, unlike other forms of creative writing, it really lends itself to collaboration, that it's both more fun and easier to do when you're working with others, because when the creative brains collide, they'll come up with a better or sharper line or joke and that kind of thing. So for sure. In fact, I do it all the time. As the book has come out, I've done a seminar or two here or there, and by the end of a couple hours, everybody walks out of there with a freshly written piece of humor. I even think if you can learn how to write funny things, you can learn how to write anything, because you're always speaking to an audience, and I think that translates regardless of what kind of thing you're writing.
Well, what is the important difference, or are there important differences between writing a humor piece, something that's intended for to be read off the page like that, and then the kind of thing that we had been talking about before that the funny man starts out trying to do, and that is getting up in front of a group of people and doing material and trying to put it across that way.
Yeah, the difference is sort of stand-up comedy, where you're delivering to an audience, and written humor really is sort of ones of rhythm, of impact. I think if you're up on a stage trying to make people laugh, you can't wait 30 seconds in between laughs. You need them laughing consistently. And if you're writing a something funny, sort of a classic humorous essay, like Swift's A Modest Proposal, it's not funny for the first 300 or 400 words until you get the joke. So there's definitely some demands there, and even, I'll read for audiences, and I'll read things that have been printed that I feel are humorous, and often I'll have to retool them for reading out loud if I want the audience to really respond. I think listening and reading are just kind of two different processes that require, again, attention to audience. What does the audience need at any given time?
Yeah. Well, we talked a little bit earlier about the story, about the funny man, and about how he develops this thing. And if people weren't listening, his thing, his trademark is he does impressions with his fist stuffed in his mouth. Inspired by his baby son, who liked to stuff his fist in his mouth. And so the funny man does that one night when he's with the baby, and the baby thinks it's pretty hilarious. So he goes on to do it for audiences who think it's hilarious, and he becomes a smash hit doing this thing, which then, of course, people expect him to do. And part of the book, though, is also a kind of an exploration of the price of fame and what happens to you when people get a particular idea about who you are and what they want to see you do. On the strength of his success as a stand-up comedian, he goes on to make a movie, which at least he thinks is a terrible movie, although it's also a success.
Right.
There's also a bit in that story where the starlet who's in the movie with him suggests that they have sex. And essentially makes this argument, says, well, you know, one of these days, one or the other of us will be famous or could be famous. So then, you know, we could say that we had done it. And he's sort of, he doesn't quite know what to make of this. She explains it very nicely. I hope people will read it just for how it is that she makes the pitch on this. And he's married, and for probably mostly the right reasons, he says no. But then as she's walking out the door, he says, well, you can say we did if you want to. And she does.
Right.
Which then she does out in print. And it ends up wrecking his life and his marriage because his wife, the funny man's wife, thinks that, in fact, he did when he didn't.
Right.
But all of that is sort of a long way of illustrating that being a, you know, what it's like to be a prisoner of fame and how people say things about you that aren't necessarily true, but you have to live with those things.
Right, but yeah, and people will believe them is sort of the unfortunate part. And you know, his attitude about himself is that he kind of deserves these bad things that have happened to him, except not for the reasons everybody else thinks, because he did not cheat on his wife and he did not do some of these things people believe about him. But once you become famous, the things people know about your life and your life are not your own. I was watching Entertainment News last night, and there's a rumor that Beyonce is not really pregnant, that somehow she's faking her pregnancy, and she has a surrogate carrying her baby. And this is kind of objectively, I believe, just a lunatic notion. This would be a crazy thing for somebody to do, and yet here on a, albeit entertainment news broadcast, it's the lead story and gets 5 minutes, and anybody who encounters the internet will hear it. And I begin to wonder, what is that like for Beyonce, somebody who is having her first child under this sort of glare? And so I wanted to play with that in the book, this notion of even the funny man himself begins to realize that who he thinks he is doesn't really matter in the face of who other people think he is. He begins to behave accordingly. If they want him to be famous, he might as well act like a famous person.
Which amounts to being a jerk.
Right, which it's being selfish and self-involved.
Yes. Yes.
And using other people and not really caring about the consequences of anything, which, of course, again, the irony is it only gets him in more and more trouble. I forget how much I put this guy through until people start recounting my own book to me. I'm like, oh, wow, that was mean. He really can't catch a break. But, you know, that's not so different from a lot of lives, I think.
I guess I did find myself just being a tiny bit disappointed in the funny man's wife that she doesn't believe him, that in fact, he did not have sex with that woman, the starlet in the movie.
Right. Well, in her defense, he has been acting erratically. And at one point in their couples therapy, he decides, in order to get past it, because everybody assumes that he did sleep with her, he just says, okay, I did. Can we drop it now? And she actually does start to forgive him, except then he gets upset that he's being labeled this cheater. So he goes back on it, and now she doesn't know what to think. So he really screws it up at that point.
Yeah. Just for a second, going back to the Beyonce thing, the thing that I always think about that those kinds of stories, and of course there are those kinds of stories about people who are celebrities and people seem to be consumed with how they live their lives and who they're in bed with and who they're married to and who they're getting divorced from and are they having children or not and all that sort of thing. I guess I find myself repeatedly looking at stories like that and thinking, who cares? Why would anybody care?
Right.
Who
right.
cares? I mean, I wish Beyonce well, you know, I also feel like, well, who cares? Why does anybody care?
Yeah, I mean, that is the zillion-dollar question. I don't know why I care. I really don't care. And yet, these things come across my radar, and I head towards them like a moth to a light. And it really is bizarre. It's actually something I wrote about in regards to some of my own attitudes, where the funny man starts his own this television show starring his former servant. And the name of the show I can't pronounce on the radio.
Yes.
Kicking the butt, if you substitute a word. And a competing show that's even sort of more hard-edged and vicious than what The Funny Man has conceived comes in and becomes more popular. And The Funny Man himself, even though he loathes this other show, not just because it makes his show unpopular, but because he recognizes it as sort of the lowest common human denominator, can't help but watch it every time it's on. And it's sort of inexplicable. It's even, you know, The Real Housewives of Beverly Hills. I find the show itself disgusting and reprehensible. But as soon as I see, you know, if it's on and there's three women yelling and arguing at each other, I turn and look. I don't know if I'm just an emotional rubbernecker or if there's something in the American psyche, but for whatever reason, we are drawn to these things that are completely trivial and not meaningful. And part of my motive was to examine those things. You know, what is driving those things? I don't think I have any answers, but I was curious enough to noodle around with it for a while.
Yeah, well, that to me, again, here there are some more very interesting questions. Not only the question, why is it that you should, if you were in the business of creating television programming, you should be able to make a buck humiliating people.
Right.
But going further, why is it there are people who seem to be queuing up to be the ones being humiliated, who willingly, in these shows that are called quote-unquote reality shows,
right?
Why people would subject themselves to that kind of public humiliation, doing really stupid things and looking shallow and, you know, being very human, but doing that on a national stage. Why would anybody do that?
Yeah, I think, you know, I think it goes all the way back to one of your first questions, is why does a comedian get up on stage and try to make people laugh? I think it's the same reason. I think people want to be noticed. They want to be seen as special. And they really are willing to humiliate themselves in order to have that moment in the sun, to have their 15 minutes. You know, there's a show on ABC. It's like a game show called Wipeout, where people try to survive this obstacle course, except the thing is completely rigged. There's no way to get past this obstacle course. It's designed to bash them around and throw them in the mud and spray them with foam and essentially... you know, like a Three Stooges cartoon, only for real with average people, and I'm sure they're overwhelmed with volunteers.
Yeah, I think that's the show that was there. I think they actually stole that idea from the Japanese.
Oh yeah,
The difference is
a long tradition there.
The difference is on the Japanese show, it's actually possible to win. Very few people do, but it's actually possible to win. And the difference between the Japanese show and the American show is that what they're trying to do is with the American show is essentially make it impossible for anybody to win.
Yeah, it's completely rigged. Yeah. You can be walking across sort of a balance beam, and then a 15-foot wall comes out and just slams you into the water. There's no skill. There's no strategy. It really is because we enjoy, I don't know we, but a significant portion of the American public enjoys humiliation enough to make it broadcastable.
It's like volunteering to be Wile E. Coyote.
right, which I'm sure if it's, you know, I think you should go pitch that. Take that to Hollywood.
I better note this down. Yeah, ideas like that don't come along every day.
Right, like you try to catch some sort of robotic roadrunner, and you're in the place of Wile E. Coyote, and they strap some roller skates and a rocket onto your back and see what happens. That's as plausible as any other show out there. Yeah. I think get out of this radio hosting business. You're destined for a reality competition show.
Kid, there's a big future awaiting you in the world of reality television. Well, this gets us to something that you also invent in the book, which I think is wonderful, but it's dangerously wonderful because I'm afraid somebody might try to do it, and that is he in the course of the book sort of jumps back and forth between giving us the story of the funny man's life from his point of becoming fame and his rise and fall, but also the what happens when he is there is an attempted mugging, and he ends up shooting the mugger, and that's all I'll say about that. But he's put on trial because he's seen doing this. So he's put on trial, and at some point his attorney comes up with this thing that I think is wonderful and also scary because I'm afraid somebody might do it, is he decides to mount this defense that the funny man is not guilty by reason of celebrity.
Right.
Because as we all know, famous people aren't like the rest of us. And I like that, as I say, I like that, and yet there's something kind of scary about that.
Right. Yeah, no, the inspiration for that was its actual real legal precedent, which is this notion of diminished capacity, that you can be not guilty of a crime, particularly a crime like murder, because of some condition that leaves you unable to be responsible for your own actions, something like being mentally ill or having a psychotic break or this kind of thing. And so I began to think about this and realize, you know, being a celebrity could be seen as a diminished capacity, in that you are almost by definition separated from the world as a average real person would see it, and that world would begin to look very different to you. And there's plenty of precedent in our past for celebrities who have quite literally gotten away with murder, mostly because they're celebrities. And as you say, I never thought it was that big a stretch. I think you could see all kinds of cases where perhaps this has already played a role. You know, on the other hand, sometimes celebrities are picked on because they're famous. Like, I'm not sure if Lindsay Lohan wasn't famous, I'm not sure she'd be on trial for allegedly stealing this necklace like she is. But it sort of just goes to show that she lives in, you know, celebrities live in a different world, and I think it's reasonable to think that they don't see the world the same way the non-famous do.
But that's also, I think, her particular case, it's a sort of a sad illustration of the fact that you have, sometimes you have people, and I'm sure that there are plenty of celebrities that are very nice people that, as much as possible, given that they are a celebrity, try to live normal lives. And those are the people I feel bad for being hounded by paparazzi and the tabloid press and so forth. But in a case like that, you see someone who seems to have actually talent, an attractive young woman, has demonstrated some capacity for acting, and you someone to whom a lot has been given. And you wonder, that given all that, why can't you get your act together?
Right. How could you screw this up?
How could you screw? Yeah. How could you screw? Given everything you know, everything you've got, everything you could be doing, how could you repeatedly screw this up?
Right. No. It's sad. I do. You know. It's again. It's this duality that I'm very interested in as a writer. On the one hand, I look at her and just think, oh, what is wrong with you? You could get your act together, and you could go make $1 million next week, just by being sober and ready to act. You can make more money in a week than I'll make in my lifetime just by doing that. On the other hand, she's clearly messed up, and something messed her up that is in her control but not entirely at the same time. So, you know, one of the things the funny man's lawyer, Barry, says to him fairly early in the book about how that he needs to make the jury think about the funny man in order for him to get off is not that we want to feel sympathy to the funny man, because who could really feel sympathy for that kind of person? But what we do need is empathy, that is understanding. And that's what I sort of think about in cases like Lindsay Lohan. I'm not sympathetic to her. She could solve her problems like that. On the other hand, I do think it's an interesting proposition to try to understand her, to bring empathy to how somebody could have all of these things, all of these advantages, and yet screw it up so badly.
Yeah. And for in a way, too, I think for maybe for somebody like that, well, certainly for the character that you've created, there is possibility for sympathy. In the end of the book, it's sort of an open question about what happens And it seems to be one of those cases where the door opens and the person starts to step through, but you really don't know where that door goes.
Right.
And you want him to be okay somehow after having followed him through everything that he's been through, a lot of which is his own fault. You still somehow at the end want to feel like, well, maybe it's possible for this guy to put it all together and to be okay.
Yeah, I mean, I'm glad to hear that response, because that's how I feel about him, because we're all allowed to mess up in our lives. We all do things that are incomprehensible and stupid. The famous just happened to do them on a much grander and more public scale, so that he manages to mess up a lot of his life, and maybe, as you say, the end is deliberately ambiguous about some of this, maybe continuing to mess it up or make it worse. My hope is that we do want the best for these people, that even, you know, Lindsay Lohan, that we would cheer if she was able to get it together and have a comeback, that we don't absolutely wish for her final comeuppance, because those things are tragic when something like that happens, when an Amy Winehouse dies so young because she can't get away from those kinds of demons. I don't think American culture is so far gone that we celebrate those things. We mourn them. So I think maybe that's something I'm hoping for at the end, is this idea of not a life wasted, but a life gone off track, and hoping that it gets back.
Yeah. Well, readers can find all of this and more in John Warner's new novel, his first novel, The Funny Man. It's published by Soho Press. Is out now. John will be here visiting the campus where he went to school. He went to school here at the University of Illinois and also taught here. He'll be here next week, Monday the 17th, and making an appearance in the Carr series. Writers come to the campus and they work with students and they give readings. He'll be at the Alina Union Bookstore in the Author's Corner 4:30 on Monday afternoon, so anybody who is interested can stop by. Also, you might want to stop by McSweeney's Internet Tendency for a little bit of entertainment. Bookmark that, and every once in a while check and see, because there's always new things there. Our guest is now currently teaching at the College of Charleston in South Carolina. Hey, thanks very much for talking with us.
Oh, it's a real pleasure. Thank you. It's up in our lives. We all do things that are incomprehensible and stupid. The famous just happened to do them on a much grander and more public scale, so that he manages to mess up a lot of his life, and maybe, as you say, the end is deliberately ambiguous about some of this, maybe continuing to mess it up or make it worse. My hope is that we do want the best for these people, that even, you know, Lindsay Lohan, that we would cheer if she was able to get it together and have a comeback, that we don't absolutely wish for her final comeuppance, because those things are tragic when something like that happens, when an Amy Winehouse dies so young because she can't get away from those kinds of demons. I don't think American culture is so far gone that we celebrate those things. We mourn them. So I think maybe that's something I'm hoping for at the end, is this idea of not a life wasted, but a life gone off track, and hoping that it gets back.
Yeah. Well, readers can find all of this and more in John Warner's new novel, his first novel, The Funny Man. It's published by Soho Press. Is out now. John will be here visiting the campus where he went to school. He went to school here at the University of Illinois and also taught here. He'll be here next week, Monday the 17th, and making an appearance in the Carr series. Writers come to the campus and they work with students and they give readings. He'll be at the Alina Union Bookstore in the Author's Corner 4:30 on Monday afternoon, so anybody who is interested can stop by. Also, you might want to stop by McSweeney's Internet Tendency for a little bit of entertainment. Bookmark that, and every once in a while check and see, because there's always new things there. Our guest is now currently teaching at the College of Charleston in South Carolina. Hey, thanks very much for talking with us.
Oh, it's a real pleasure. Thank you.
WILL programs are made possible by Bevere Cafe. Bevere Cafe offers specialty coffees, breakfast featuring a choice of cold and hot breakfast items from 8 a.m. to 11 a.m., and to-go sandwiches and salads for lunch. Bevere Cafe is student-operated in Bevere Hall, corner of Gregory and Goodwin, Urbana.
That's it for us on Focus. Up next, the Afternoon Magazine, the host, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD3 Urbana. Let's take a look at commodity prices. In Kansas City, December wheat 702, down 27 and 3 quarters. March 719 and a half, down 26 and a half. December wheat in Chicago, 626 and a half, down 34 and a quarter. The March contract, 662 and a quarter, down 32 and three quarters. December corn, 638 and a half, down 6 and a half. March, 650 and a half, down 7. May, 657 and a quarter, down 7 and a half. July, down 7 and a half at 661 and three quarters. November beans, unchanged at 1235 and a half. January, 1246, down 1 quarter. March, 1253 and three quarters, down 1 and a quarter. May, 1256 and three quarters, down 4 and a half. October meal, 318 even, up 110. October oil, 5169, down 26. October live cattle, 12072 and a half, down 65. The December contract, 12137 and a half, down 25. October